Hello, ramblers and gamblers. Josh Rosenthal here. Thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. On today's pod, we are bringing the drama, ladies and gents. We are bringing the drama. Golf drama with Jeff Feinberg of Mayo Media Network and Odds Checker. We're talking U.S. Open, LIV Golf guys versus PGA guys. Already seeing a little bit of cold shoulder action this week, stuff you don't normally see in golf. And then we're doing Commanders drama, which, man, does that team have a lot of drama. Senior writer for The Athletic, Ben Standig, is joining us for that one. I want to ask him about these recent Jack Del Rio comments and how he thinks players are or are not responding. We'll talk about the Commanders over-under for wins on the season two, also a little bit of Carson Wentz and Terry McLaurin's contract. Anyway, let's get things started with Jeff Feinberg. Jeff, great having you on, my man. I tell you what, we've got a lot to talk about. There is a lot going on in the world of golf, huh?
Too much going on where I'd almost argue the drama this early in the week hasn't lived up to maybe some of my expectations, but yeah, it's a lot to take in. I've never really cared so much for like the full press conferences either, but I find myself catching them.
So I'm a wrestling fan, pro wrestling, dudes in spandex, and despite golf typically, I think it's fair to say, being among the tamer major sports, I kind of feel like right now we've got almost an NWO light storyline going. Bear with me here. You have a heel turn from one of the most popular golfers of all time, right? Phil Mickelson pulls a Hollywood Hogan and becomes a bad guy by joining LIV Golf, the Saudi tour. Other guys join him, including Dustin Johnson. And then this week, all those dudes who some would say turn their back on the PGA Tour are going to go head to head with the players who did not, because a lot of the LIV guys may not be able to play in PGA events, but many of them can play in the majors, including this weekend's U.S. Open. And we're already seeing a little bit of friction. You tweeted something about Jordan Spieth, a PGA guy, apparently giving Kevin Na, a LIV guy, a little bit of a cold shoulder. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so that was just me, you know, retweeting and playing into the drama and the fodder. I don't know the inner workings of that. For all I know, 10 seconds later, Spieth acknowledged Kevin Na. That being said, Josh, I, like you, am a fan of the sport of kings in spandex. Uh-huh. And I, like you, have been making these analogies for some time, even of the initial rumors. It reeked of you know, Hall and Nash in the more money, less dates, like guaranteed money. I get to work less. Like, it just right away, it just had those sorts of vibes.
Yeah. And,
well, wrestling and golf, you could argue, you know, not many people, I think it's have this, are fans of both. That's a super niche crossover. They're both incredibly popular sports at two polar opposite ends of the spectrum. And people might be in that I think wrestling a sport, but just two, you know, very popular forms of entertainment, but they're just at the very opposite ends of socioeconomic spectrum. The commercials you get when you're watching wrestling are not the same as the commercials you get when watching golf, but they share a level of popularity outside of the mainstream, you know, major sports that I think in some ways is very similar. So I do think there are many like layers that I am going to wrestling and the battles of old potentially in my mind as this has all played out.
Here's another one. Huge part of professional wrestling is the crowd reaction. That's not normally the case with golf, at least in most tourneys. However, it may be, at least to an extent with this one. What do you think the reaction, the fan reaction is going to be for guys like Lefty, like DJ, the other LIV guys out there?
See, that's an interesting one, because in this sort of like Twitter ecosystem, we'll tell you that they'll be like incredibly vocal towards those guys. But I don't know necessarily that they will. I mean, it's hard to really make, like, Bryson and Reed always get a bit of a, you know, a different layer of the audience. As Sergio and Poulter, Northeast majors, like, they always get it tough. So I would never be, you know, that surprised to see them get it. And I don't know how keenly aware just the golf guy who just likes to play golf and is going to the U.S. Open is of this dynamic. So I'm honestly not totally sold either way how it's going to go in terms of the crowd at all. I will expect a few heckles, some guys and some smart comments, but I don't know that's going to be like the full crowd turn like we might get in wrestling.
Mickelson was asked about the fan reaction at his presser on Monday. He said, "I respect and understand their opinions. They have strong feelings, and I respect that." That was the quote. Speaking of the presser, I think this was the first time that he's talked with U.S. media since this all really blew up from the Shipnuck, article, book, and all that. It didn't seem to me like Phil really said much of anything, which I guess at this point might have been the point. Was that your read on it too, Jeff?
Yeah, no, he didn't say much of anything, but at the same time, you know, he was the first guy out. He didn't have to speak. That's another thing people should realize. He did not have to. Now, I'm sure the weight of not speaking and then, you know, guys jumping out of bushes to ask him a question might have, like, been more annoying potentially than having to face the music yesterday. And, you know, Phil Mickelson, he's one of the true great sports figures of our time. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be some 5-part Golf Channel docu-series one day. And sometimes with these athletes, Josh, you know, when they, every time that they feel more human, they can kind of be more relatable. And Phil's a flawed figure, and he's been through a lot. And at moments, watching it, like, you kind of felt sympathetic, even though I do believe it's their choice to make with the whole live stuff. But you've got to also, people are allowed to be really upset, and you've got to live with the other side of the coin, I guess, no pun intended. Everyone is totally entitled to how they feel, and I think the questions, on all of them for the most part, are totally fair to be asked if you want to sort of take that road.
The absolute most insane outcome for this tourney this weekend would be Phil winning, right? I imagine Phil winning this U.S. Open would be among the crazier things to ever happen in golf. You think I'm on the right track?
Yeah, you're 100% on the right track. And I would go as so far to say he doesn't even have to win. It could honestly be like that Tom Watson at the Open a handful of years ago. I feel like it was Sink who edged him out. But let's just go to a Saturday night where Phil's in a final group with one of the preeminent PGA stars. I mean, oh, like,
God, what, like him and Rory. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, just what that sort of buildup would be. He doesn't even have to win to sort of be able to carry the oxygen for the whole week. And on that note of oxygen, the irony, and like, Tiger's played the two majors, he's not here for this one. Now Phil comes in, takes the oxygen. What a crazy, crazy ride. While at the same time, two super elites and favorites win both of the majors we've had so far. So not complaining either, just sort of replaying it all in my head as we talk about it.
Not to mention that this is the one major that Phil has not won. It's the only one. He has finished second or tied for second in 99, 02, 04, 06, 09, and 2013, but he's never broken all the way through. Anything else you want to hit regarding the LIV PGA feud before we talk betting for this weekend, Jeff? Absolutely anything.
Geez, there's so many roads you could take. The, you know, the morality, the geopolitical. I would just say, like, you know, it's weird when, and I, again, anyone can make their choice. And I think we live in a world of so many crazy hypocrisies, and not to turn this into any political, but when even your president's going over to cozy the relationship, it definitely emboldens a golfer who's thinking about it to be like, why can't I do that? Like, if our government is over certain acts, horrible acts of the past, why should I not be able to be over them? While at the same time, the people who are very fairly still will never get over that stuff, I think, are totally in the right to their opinion. But if this was truly special and felt good, wouldn't there be some LIV press conference this week at some Four Seasons off in Boston where Phil and DJ are getting $200 checks with smiles, the same way what would happen when your team signs a Scott Boras client? Like, it's right. a celebration. Now, I'm not saying this is the same. It's not the same as a player going from the Yankees to the Dodgers. Like, it is not. You're still playing for MLB. You're still under the same union. You're still teammates in the collective game. But to think these sorts of deals in sports have happened and there's some level of, like, shame around them, at least publicly, like, that's just almost all you need to know in some respects.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how we look back on this wild, wild time in golf, because I think the jury is really still out on that one. As for this weekend, here are the top five guys, according to FanDuel. As of Tuesday afternoon, Rory is the favorite to win it all. 10-1, followed by Justin Thomas, 12-1. Scottie Scheffler, 15-1. John Rahm, also 15-1. And then Cam Smith rounds out the top five. He is 21-1. Any of those guys stand out to you, Jeff? Or do you like somebody who's not in that top group even better?
I mean, I find myself, we get to majors, I catch myself sort of beholden to that, like, next tier and above. In fact, a full disclosure, Josh, everyone it seems I've bet on this week has never won a major championship before. Well, those four you mentioned are tried and tested. And if I did have to play up at the top, I guess let's just start quickly. The last handful of U.S. Opens, Spieth, Dustin, Brooks, Woodland sneaks in there, Bryson, Rahm. I mean, the USGA is giving us a prototype. And I'm just going to go swinging at that prototype. And some would argue I should be betting closer to the very top based on those names I've told you. But you got to hit it long. You got to be somewhat accurate. You've got to have some sort of bogey avoidance and ability to get up and down. But those names, I mean, it's hard to find a true outlier, when looking at the names. And I'd rather be wrong chasing that profile that the USGA has told me to chase than try to make one up, if that makes any sense. So yeah, the really good players see the ice here, even at the US Open. We turned that back nine. It was like Brooks, Morikawa, Rory, Bryson, Louis was in it. He stayed the longest, and Rahm came out on top. Like, even the guys battling was just a heavyweight fight. Even when they went to Pebble Beach and Woodland did win, and you think, oh, they don't have to club up there, they can club down. It was Chez Reavie surrounded by the 12 best drivers in the world on that leaderboard. So yeah, that's the US Open prototype. And all four of those guys certainly fit it. For my money, I would just take the bigger odds on Scheffler and Rahm, because I do feel very little separates any of those players. That would be my opinion.
Okay. All right. 15-1 on both those guys at the moment, although I'm sure that's going to move a little bit by the time we get to Thursday. Scheffler's an interesting one. I saw this is Kyle Porter tweeted this, but since World War II, here's a list of players who have won both the Masters and the U.S. Open in the same year. So Scheffler, because he won the Masters, would be added to the list. It's not a long one. Hogan, Jack, Palmer, Tiger, Spieth. Pretty impressive company there. Were Scheffler able to break out this weekend? Anybody else? Like, I've heard you talk a couple times this week about M, right? You like M, 36-1, Sungjae M?
Yeah, so he was a bet I made a few weeks ago. I did catch a bigger number, but I still am such a fan of his this week. I think we're going to – how do you put this? I am looking at what you would maybe call quote-unquote boring players, and I think he checked those boxes to a T. Just a very clean driver of the ball, incredibly accurate long iron player. He's second on tour in bogey avoidance, which I think is absolutely crucial this week. One of the most important stats, in my opinion. But it's also, everyone's going to make your bogeys. You almost just want to avoid making your doubles. But he's just a very clean player. I'd almost like a poor man Xander Schauffele, who I also do like this week. You'd have to pay up for. But just a sort of player, Josh, that does everything like an 8.5. And sometimes you get frustrated that, like, oh, I wish you had that extra gear, that thing you did, like, super amazing. But I really do believe this week is going to call for just that, like, steadiness across the board in your game. And those are the type of players that I am at least attempting to identify, while also sticking to that long-term U.S. Open profile, while also acknowledging there's no point in going too far down the betting board, because that could kind of feel like a donation, as past winners have shown us.
Don't I know it, man? And for the record, for the listeners, I'm not necessarily advocating, and I imagine you're not either, Jeff, taking all these guys to win it. I'm using their odds to win it just as a point of reference, but maybe you want to do a top 25 bet on some of these guys. That's
the fun part about golf betting. You can choose your own adventure. There's daily matchups. There's tournament matchups. There's placings. I have found myself in this peg of liking and enjoying picking outright winners, but I'm going to be here next week at the Travelers. I was doing it last week at the RBC. It's something I do week in, week out. I can hit my quota, or at least come close to it, over the full season. That can be a very expensive or way to just sort of jump in for a major. My friends, who I think are the smartest bettors that I know, they like laugh at outright bets because they're like, you're picking a guy to win a 150-man golf tournament. There's not a number big enough, even on a John Rahm or a Justin Thomas. The amount of variables that actually have to occur, for that guy to win, they look at the matchup boards. A matchup board, you could look at it like a college basketball Saturday. There's like 75 games. The books aren't going to be bang on with everything. There's going to be mistakes, maybe, if you can identify them. I'm no college basketball expert. I don't mean it like that, but I just mean there are markets in golf that, like, the true gamblers that love their models and their data can take full advantage of. The outright market is heavily skewed to the house, but it's also the most fun. You ever have a Sunday ticket, a heater in your pocket? I mean, that, like, you know, at a big number, I mean, that's almost worth it in and of itself. Just do it responsibly. I always
gamble responsibly, and I agree with you. It is fun. I've been playing a lot of matchups. A few other notables I'll just mention here. DJ 44-1 to win it right now. Kepka 55-1. And of course, with everything happening this week, got to mention Phil. Lefty is 220-1. You like any of those three, Jeff?
So Phil and Kepka, no. Who is the
DJ 44 to 1.
DJ, geez. Every time I've bet the US Open the last handful of years, I'm not always betting DJ, but it's truly like the Dustin Johnson profile that I chase. That is what rises at the US Open. Now we see guys with the Dustin Johnson profile that are just prolific putters and chippers of the ball at such a young age, where it took Dustin to being 30 years old. So it does kind of pain me to just be putting him off. I don't know how you could be focused. Maybe that's, that works for Dustin, because, we like to joke, but, it's not like focus seems to be his, like, strong suit. So who cares? But I don't know. You get that kind of bag right before the US Open. I'm not here for it. Brooks hasn't played in enough competition. I'm not going there. He's won once in 3 years on a comfort course in Phoenix. I'm just not buying what he might be trying to sell me at the moment. I don't even think he's trying to sell it, to be perfectly honest. I think he's pretty aware. And Phil,
he certainly wasn't at his media availability. Kepka.
Yeah, he tried. He's like, I don't play a lot anyway. I've been grinding. But yeah, I didn't like how he was I took offense, and not personal offense. I thought it was disingenuous for him to be offended by, like, three live questions. You're a top five profile golfer in the world, let alone America. You can't handle three live questions. It almost made you, like, want to give Phil Mickelson an ovation when you saw how Brooks handled three questions. When we all know Brooks would have been offended. Right. I'm not here to, like, he would have been offended. If he did 10 minutes with the media, Josh, and no one asked Brooks, have you been offered a deal by Liv? He's got the right to have an ego. He has a right to be offended, but we all know he would. I know, I don't know him, but I am so confident to say he would have been offended to not have been asked his opinion on Liv, or asked if he'd been offered a deal from them. So yeah. I'll die on that hill. And as for Phil, when he won the PGA last year, I literally looked to the clouds like we're living in some Truman Show. So if he wins this one, I'm looking for the exit. Like, I'm looking for the stage light doors over top somewhere, because impossible. I almost see, like, a miscut 80-80, and I don't even think you can make money on that, because I think that might be the general expectation for Phil this week.
I don't think he makes the cut either for whatever that's worth. Real quick, Jeff, because I don't want to keep you too long. Any other specific bets that you want to throw out there that maybe our listeners should consider? And it's okay if you don't have any also.
I have looked at, there is a market. I've bet Patrick Reed to be the top live player this week. I know that's a fun little thing. I know a lot of people just want to blindly fade the guys, but it's going to play US Open tough. The way Reed has been driving the ball lately, that is a bet that's probably not available everywhere. I bet Adam Scott.
What odds did you get on Reed? Do you remember?
That was plus 650, which I thought was kind of fair. Although I am more fearful of Louis than anyone else, because we all know how prolific and clean he can be in a US Open. And Reed can be wonky, but I feel like if it really shows its teeth, I'm here for Reed. And yeah, I don't know.
And Scott, what'd you have on Scott?
Yeah, I catch myself cheering for Reed. Scott, top Australian. I got that at 3-1. It's obviously, it's a deep group of them. We have Cam Smith and Leishman. I just feel like he's so prolific off the tee with an ability to be long and straight. And, you know, US Open, you don't have to, like, have a birdie party. While Cam Smith can make par from anywhere, his liability can be off the tee. And maybe this week that can almost just, you know, just disqualify you out of the gate. Obviously, he has that Spieth-ian magic bean ability around the green. I'm not disrespecting him. If he won, I wouldn't even be shocked. But so those are some different markets that I am playing in. And also, like, an Abraham Answer, he's about 100-1 to win the tournament. I'm playing him in a top 40 market. I think the US Open does suit a guy like him quite well.
I love it. Those are really good. I think this is part of the reason why I've gotten into golf, because I'm not even a golfer. I mean, I've hacked my way through nine, enough times, but I love the, like, you know, top Australian, top live golfer. I love the different options.
It's really crazy how many, like I said, the type of roads and choose your own adventure golf betting you can make.
Yeah.
I sometimes like to avoid the daily matchups because, yeah, it's like anyone that's picked up a club, good or bad, can know like how weird like one singular day can be in a moment in time. It's almost like betting a baseball game in 162. The worst team, you know, still going to win like 60 ball games in that matchup. But golf's a lot of fun, and people that don't even play, it's, you can catch like this bug of like DFS and golf, because it can, it's a really fun sport to dabble around it.
It is an underrated gambling sport, my man. I cannot stress that enough for listeners who haven't tried it.
And people like put their foot in the water for the majors, and then all of a sudden they're hooked and betting like the Sanderson Farms. It's a weird, it's just, yeah.
Right, you know, right here, buddy. I'm totally with you. Jeff, this has been great. Where can listeners find you? Plug away.
You can find me. I do a golf show every Monday morning with my guy, Pat Mayo, at the Mayo Media Network. And my outright picks for this week at the U.S. Open, they'll be up at oddschecker.com/US, Oddschecker U.S. YouTube feed. Go check that out.
Jeff Feinberg, Mayo Media Network, Odds Checker. Appreciate you coming on, my man. Happy gambling this weekend. I hope it's a good one.
It'd be great to catch a Sunday hero, Josh.
You're telling me, man. Fingers crossed. Take it easy. Joining me now to talk about the never-ending soap opera that is the Washington Commanders, Ben Standing, senior writer for The Athletic, covers the team. Great to have you on, Ben. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks for having me. Never-ending is a very true statement. I appreciate the chance to vent.
With this team, are you ever like, I just want to write about some football. Why doesn't this other stuff off the field ever stop?
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, the last, not that this is all unique to the Ron Rivera era, but it feels like things have just been constantly accelerated over the last 3 years. You know, obviously there was the pandemic, which kind of threw everything out of whack for every team. But then in that range, we had the harassment aspect within the organization. Then there's that leads to the name change. They're looking for a stadium that crosses three different jurisdictions. Obviously, more recently now we have the situation with Jack Del Rio and his comments about January 6th. And, you know, there's tons of things in between that have happened. And it just, it, before there were things that would happen, but there would be like sort of the one thing, maybe two things, and then you could kind of get back to football. And I'll be honest, like with mini camp starts this week, mandatory mini camp. And I, you know, I would like, to your point of like, we'd like to talk about football. It is hard for me right now to just say, hey, let's have a conversation about who's going to play right guard, or what are they going to do about the 11th defender, or how does Jahan Dotson look? Those things still seem all small minded when it's over and over and over again, these bigger topics that my colleagues on other normal beats just don't have to deal with in, you know, in totality.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I want to get into all of this, and we are going to talk some actual on-field stuff towards the end of this interview. But off the top, I've heard you joke about needing to provide a timestamp anytime you talk about the Commanders, since news breaks so quickly with this team. So we're having this chat Monday. I just want to get that out of the way. We're doing it Monday because Ben's going to be swamped at the team's mandatory mini camp, which starts Tuesday. And you know, like I've told you, Ben, I really want to have you on to talk about some of this stuff just because you're so well connected. And let's start with the Del Rio. I was going to run through everything. By my count, I think the team's being investigated by five different entities, if I'm not mistaken right now. You've got the NFL, the FTC, officials in both DC and Virginia, and you have the congressional committee that now wants Dan Snyder to talk. And then on top of that, you have all the moving stuff, and then you have these Jack Del Rio comments. He initially called the January 6th attack on the Capitol a dust up, since apologized for that phrasing, and he's been fined $100K, and also, I believe, deleted his Twitter account last weekend too. Ben, I know most players would probably, at least on the record, say everything that's happened off the field, Del Rio stuff included, doesn't affect them. So, for instance, I saw Jonathan Allen was quoted by NBC Sports Washington as saying, I don't care about his opinion. As long as he shows up every day and he works hard, that's what I want for my defensive coordinator. But you're in the locker room, man. You talk to a lot of these guys on the record and off. Are you buying that all this stuff that's happening off the field doesn't impact them on the field as well?
Well, I mean, so for one, you know, we actually haven't been in the locker room now for a couple of years because of the nature of COVID. We're expected to be back in this season, but we're not there yet. So we're talking with players at more of a distance, you know, so it is a little bit different to, you know, having that casual conversation that may lead to something than having the formal discussions.
That's great. I'm glad you pointed that. So you guys are talking, you're talking to the players, but you're talking via Zoom. It's not the casual locker room chat. Is that accurate?
Right. And okay. And obviously, you know, as a reporter, you try to like ask around, but you know, so much of the roster, I haven't done the math of like how many people are still on the team from when we were last in the locker room, but it's obviously been a big significant turnover. I have not been in the locker room since Chase Young has been on the team, you know, as an example.
Jeez.
So it's hard to say from that sort of perspective, but I mean, I will just say that independent of that, you know, Jack Del Rio has been here since January of 2020, and he's been pretty active on Twitter speaking about politics that whole time. I did my first interview with him back in August of 2020. There was a component of that interview was about his activism on Twitter, and do players, Does he worry that his comments will, you know, find players that don't agree with him or whatever? And he said he wasn't worried about it, but he would have a conversation as needed, which is kind of what he said the other day. And I do think it's notable that no player, as far as I can think of, on the team has come forward at any point here, including right now, and said anything about these comments. Now, people on other, you know, outside the organization have done that. But nobody here has. So obviously it's notable that Jack Del Rio is the person who determines their playing time and their role, thus their livelihood. And, you know, anybody who's ever a job kind of knows it maybe doesn't make sense to piss off your direct boss in some way, but these players also have a megaphone and a voice, and it's easier to get rid of the coach than the player if somebody really felt they wanted to do something, but they haven't. And I think that's notable for those who just assume that this is going to lead to locker room strife. There hasn't been any signs of that. I think there are also people in the league and perhaps in the locker room who recognize that there are people in this league who have feelings that are similar to what Del Rio expressed. And if you want to be in this industry, you have to make a determination to how much you want to stand up, or is it better to sort of bury your head in the sand and just kind of move forward? And I'm sure, there are people who do that. I mean, I've talked to some people, not necessarily in this locker room, but, you know, connected at least, or tangentially related or what have you, that have expressed that view. So, you know, again, until somebody comes out and says anything, it's hard, or, you know, or even just off the record says flat out, that guy stinks, it's a problem. Like I said, I think there are people who, the players generally, I think, like Del Rio, and are able to separate the coach from the rhetoric. So I wouldn't assume locker room strife until there's reason to assume that.
What'd you think of the $100,000 fine? Was that about what you had expected punishment wise?
I didn't even know, honestly, he would get anything. I mean, you know, everybody's making a huge point of the dust up comment, which is what he said on Wednesday. And obviously that is notable, but it also feels like that's just something that's a little bit easier to grab a hold of. He had previously tweeted on Monday of that week, he'd done the comparison of the events of how come the events of January 6th are getting far more attention than the social justice riots that occurred the summer of George Floyd's murder at the hands of police and everything that kind of went behind that. That was mentioned, I believe, in some way in the statement, because Del Rio expanded on that when he made the dust up comments. That was mentioned, but there was no mention of the statement of the tweets themselves. And it's not like these were the only tweets that he has done, that if you're going to be offended by some of this, that wouldn't have been, you couldn't have sort of made, hey, well, what about these comments? So I didn't necessarily know that they were going to say anything. We asked Ron Rivera about the tweets before Del Rio made the dust up comment, and he kind of just said, you know, I don't want to talk about it. Well, you know, if I'm going to have it, if we're going to do anything, it'll be behind closed doors. So I wasn't necessarily anticipating anything, but obviously, you know, the situation became more, you know, out of control, and more media were focused on it than the actual January 6th hearings are unfolding in the backdrop. The head of the NAACP comes out and says Del Rio should be fired, and, you know, perhaps all these things led to something. So I don't know. So I 100,000, I don't know. I mean, short of him getting fired, I don't know anything would have been enough for some people. And therefore, I don't want to say it's good or bad. I just was really not sure that anything was going to happen based on kind of where we were prior to that point.
Maybe this is something that I'm just more, you know, interested in than most. But the Coach Rivera statement about the fine certainly made it seem like this was Coach Rivera's decision. Do you think it was his sole decision? Do you think Jason Wright gets involved? Do you think the Snyders get involved? How high up does this go? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I mean, it was notable that the statement itself came from Rivera as opposed to the organization. I think that, to me, Rivera was getting, this was not a great look for him, because this was somebody on his coaching staff doing this. And, you know, I think part of the issue for me looking at this is, like, you know, on that very day, Rivera was talking about how there was a play in practice that day where a defensive player, gave a good whack to a receiver, and Rivera stopped practice, yelled at the player, kind of everybody, hey, we got to be more disciplined. You got to have discipline when it comes to being in the game. If we don't have discipline, what can go wrong? But you have a defensive coordinator who, independent of what he's saying, is talking publicly and openly about politics. And that's, whichever way you think you're going to go on that, not something that, it's something that can lead to questions and distractions. And yet he was doing this. So you're talking about discipline on the one hand over here, but you're not getting it necessarily from the defensive coordinator. And of course, everybody has the, you know, freedom of speech, and, you know, the government can't arrest you for things that you say, things like that. But at the same point, it's not like there's things go without consequences, and he's not the boss, Del Rio. He's a subordinate. He's not the guy in charge like the way Rivera is, or certainly Dan Snyder, the owner, is. So, you know, I think Rivera was taking a bit of a hit as well, that he wasn't being able to sort of control somebody on his own staff in terms of just talking at all. And I think that would be my guess as to why Rivera felt compelled, perhaps, to be the one who's putting this out there. So I don't know if Dan Snyder or Jason Wright had any say in this. I think the fact that you had people in the state of Virginia, and I think DC also, went in the conversation about the stadium, because the day after all this happened, both Virginia and DC basically said that in terms of 2022, we're out of the stadium game. And they cited the Del Rio thing, at least a couple people did, as sort of the final nail in the proverbial coffin.
Yeah.
That to me is insane. That's ridiculous. There's no way that you're making a decision on this based on Jack Del Rio's comments. But from the organizational perspective, it might have been like, hey, whatever. We don't need, I mean, ultimately, that's the thing. It's like this organization has got so many, you know, so much going on. They're doing everything they can to get out from under the mistakes that they themselves have made. These investigations you mentioned, a lot of other factors, they don't need more. And Del Rio, his comments, again, regardless of what he said, the fact that he's even talking about this could potentially lead to a further distraction. It did. That didn't help. So it's possible some higher ups were like, hey, we can't keep having this. We're trying to do bigger things here. So maybe, but it does feel like this is more of a Rivera call ultimately, for perhaps some of the reasons I was just stating.
You know, you made a couple of really good points there, because we've heard so much from this organization over the past couple of years, especially about how they're changing the culture and the past is the past. But then these new, you know, scandals and whatever else you want to call them keep popping up. This Del Rio thing being the latest example. Do you buy that this is really a new day in Commanderville under Wright and Rivera? Or is it more just that's what they keep saying, but we keep seeing these other, little things pop up that do kind of lead you to believe that maybe it's more lip service than anything else?
Well, people who listen to my podcast know I say this all the time, that, you know, there's no truer statement or truer thought that I've ever witnessed at this point in my years, of that for any organization, the tone, the competency, however you want to describe an organization, it all starts at the top. That's where a tone is set. That's where, you know, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. It all starts there. Whether Dan Snyder was in the room ever or not for any of that harassment stuff, people in the organization felt that they could get away with some of these things because I guess that, you know, it wasn't the tone of the place wasn't being set in a more respectful way, right? I mean, that has to be on some burden, on some reason why these things happen. So, you know, I'm not going to blame Dan Snyder for what Jack Del Rio had to say, or not even necessarily for some of the trials and tribulations that are occurring. But by and large, most of them, obviously a lot of them had to do with before Jason Wright, Ron Rivera ever even showed up. But at the same time, the owner is still here. Everybody else changes. The coaches change. Bruce Allen's gone. Executives are out. They've gotten rid of a bunch of these employees that were involved in these culture issues that they had. And yet, I'm not saying that the culture issues haven't changed. It does sound like things are better on a day-to-day basis inside the building, but the owner is still there. And I think ultimately you can point to any of these topics that is a huge factor. Even just the fact that Ron Rivera and Jason Wright, I'm not saying they're not good men, I'm not saying they're not competent at their jobs, but neither one of them had any experience in the actual job that they had. Not for Rivera, not as coach, but as the final decision maker, overseer of all aspects of football. He's never had that job before. Jason Wright, great resume, right? If you want to tell me he's going to be president of the United States someday or a senator, sure. But he's never been the president of an organization, or he's never really been part of an organization in this way to have this job. And now you're going to give him the craziest organization around to have to deal with. That's a lot to do. And those are choices that were made ultimately on some level, or at least signed off on by Dan Snyder. And that's why it's hard for me to sort of, yeah, say that there is a new day here just because you have new people. You may be hopeful that they can do that, and I do think there's been some benefits, some positives from their presence, but at the same point, you can't just click your finger, say we got new people and everything's going to be different when the guy at the top is still the same.
Speaking of Snyder, do you have any idea how hands-on he is right now? I mean, there's the whole thing with, no, it's Tanya Snyder running the team, and Dan may or may not have been suspended. Do you have any idea how active he is in the day-to-day of the Commanders right now?
I mean, not like, I can't tell you like what he did last week, or you know, if he's talked to Ron Rivera definitively about this Jack Del Rio thing or other records. No, but the idea that he was just sort of, you know, extracted himself from the organization as was sort of the attempt that was tried to, that was the attempt by Roger Goodell and others.
Right.
That part to me always seemed silly from the jump. I mean, even if to a degree that was true, the guy's wife is the one in charge. What are they? They have the one marriage in the world where like they literally don't talk about anything that happens at the other person's place of employment, you know, right. Or they're at what happened at work today. I mean, so like that always seemed to be kind of ridiculous. I don't necessarily know how involved he is with, say, you know, who, you know, the Carson Wentz trade or, you know, what the team should be doing at linebacker. Let alone Del Rio, but I would be naive to think he's not involved in some capacity.
Let's do a little on-field stuff before I let you go. New quarterback in town, Wentz trade, I think it's fair to say has largely been panned by the national media, but it does seem like there's some legit excitement internally. Do you think the Wentz trade is going to age well, Ben?
It's a great question. I think that the negative vibe that Carson Wentz arrived with, I think, is probably a bit much. You can look at each situation with Philadelphia and Indianapolis and certainly put some of the onus on him. You know, just his pure performance. I mean, you know, he was terrible in the last two games last year for the Colts. And if they won one of those games, they make the playoffs. And, you know, I'm sure that led to a lot of frustration. Clearly, the owner there in Indianapolis told the world he was really over the Carson Wentz era in with his group, and you know, sought to get rid of him accordingly. Some of that was on the field play, some of that was not. But at the same point, I think people are acting like Carson Wentz is this total bum of a quarterback. He's going to be the best quarterback that they've had here since either a healthy Alex Smith or, you know, Kirk Cousins before he left. He at least at a minimum raises the ceiling for what this offense is capable of, and that's not a that's not a small issue there. You know, Taylor Heineke did a commendable job last year, but he's just limited by based on his size and things like that in ways that Carson Wentz isn't. So I think there's reason to be optimistic about Carson Wentz. I mean, I think we can quibble about, did they give up too much for him? Not in terms of what it means if he's a legitimately good quarterback, but in terms of the Colts were seemingly in a tough spot to get rid of him, and yet Washington paid full sticker price. It's more like that, you know, not recognizing the room. But if he does work out, they actually, the deal will be pretty good because they didn't give up that much, relatively speaking, for a viable starting quarterback. And his salaries are not bad for a viable starting quarterback. I'm not going to sit here and I can't just sit here and say it's all good. Don't worry about it, fans. It's going to be a great day in Commanders land with Carson Wentz under center. But at the same point, I would probably guess he'll be the starting quarterback next year, an indication that, you know, he did a good enough job at a minimum and maybe a bit more to justify keeping him around and moving forward. So I think it'll work out, but I'm not saying work out like they're going to the Super Bowl, but work out like, okay, now they have a more viable starting quarterback. Can they, you know, what else can they do to help lift this thing up a notch or two?
Again, we're recording this Monday. As of now, I've seen plenty of reporting saying that Terry McLaurin is not going to be in minicamp, believe that he wants a new contract. How do you think that whole situation unfolds? Not just for minicamp, but, you know, for the future. Is Terry getting a new contract anytime soon?
So, I mean, I guess I would be optimistic that eventually he gets one. I mean, you know, deadlines create deals. Last year, they waited until like minutes before the start of training camp to sign Jonathan Allen to a deal. But Jonathan Allen also didn't skip like all the offseason program the way it looks like Terry McLaurin has. He skipped all the on-field OTAs, and now he's skipping mandatory mini camp. So that's a clear sign of frustration with these talks. The wide receiver market absolutely blew up this year, and I think that's notable,
yeah,
to say the least. And so we'll see what happens with regards to that. I just think at the same time, there's questions for me about sort of the vision that this organization has, the front office has, on what they're doing, because it isn't just Terry McLaurin. I mean, I've been reporting about Daron Payne's situation, who was, you know, their first round pick in 2018. He's got his own contract situation to go with, but you can't really deal with his until you get through McLaurin's. And you would think that there'd be some urgency to get it done, both for that reason. And also, you know, we're talking about Carson Wentz. I don't know. Don't you want your new quarterback to be getting as much work as possible with his best receiver? I don't know. Seems like a thing.
You would think so.
Right. And it's not like, and like, I don't want to say the burden is solely on Washington. I mean, Terry McLaurin, perhaps his side is asking for the stars and the moon. And the team is like, come on, man. We really like you a lot, but you're not that good. I don't know where the complete disconnect is, but I'm not getting the sense that there's this like massive motivation to hustle this thing along. And that's where I'm sort of confused by what is sort of not so much what is taking so long, but the understanding behind why they seem to be willing to allow this thing to play out. I just feel like there needs to be a bit more urgency, but I would guess ultimately something gets done, but just because something gets done doesn't mean you're going to benefit in full, especially if it leads to some, acrimony with the player. And the locker room kind of sees what's going on here with a guy who's incredibly valuable and popular, as well as what does it mean for the other guys who are waiting for deals. So I'm going to guess something will get done before training camp, but him staying out is a notable circumstance for sure.
As far as on-field stuff goes, anything else that you're going to be paying especially close attention to between now and the start of the season?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously there's the Carson Wentz, like we said, and just his level of comfort in his third offense in 3 years, things like that, and so on. I mean, defense, I keep talking about the fact that we kind of know who 10 starters are. We don't really know who the 11th will be, whether that's a traditional nickel cornerback in like a guy like Benjamin St. Juste, or if it's going to be this Buffalo nickel that got talked up a bunch last year, or what are they doing as like a third linebacker? How often do they want to play that player? I don't even know who that person is going to be. So feels a bit odd that we're this far away. We're this deep, I should say, into the offseason program and really don't have a good feel for who that 11th defender will be. I think that's something of note. And then, of course, is Curtis Samuel, after missing so much time last year with injuries, how does he make it through this entire offseason? He skipped last week's OTAs because of some overall soreness from training. We'll see where he looks like this week. And, it's fun just to see how some of the other position battles play out. But, like I said before, I think I said that here, maybe somewhere else, but it is just a little bit hard to focus on the on-field stuff that I much prefer to focus on. That when you have all these bigger picture stories just never ending, and that's just unfortunately where this team is. This is the easy time of the year to just focus on the feel-good stuff. This is spring training. Everything is great. Here's all the hope. Here's all the reason. I know we stunk last year. Here's all the reasons why we're going to be better this year, and they can't even sort of get to that easily, because all these other stories are just constantly in the air. But that's, that's where they're at.
This is a gambling podcast, so let's take it home with this, Ben. DraftKings has the Commanders over-under for season wins set at 8. Still very, very, very early. But if you had to guess, if a podcast host, we're going to make you do it, which I am, you going over-under 8 wins for the season?
I'll go over. I mean, look, they had 7 in each of the last 2 years, despite a cavalcade of random pieces at quarterback, the most important position. Carson Wentz on paper is an upgrade over what they had. The defense last year was terrible, right? I mean, certainly were way off the highs of the previous year. If they could even just be more middle of the pack, that should be a boost. So, and also then on paper, they have the easiest schedule to face, or one of the easiest schedules to face in the entire league. This is not a division with heavyweights. So there's lots of reasons. There's lots of variables there to see that they can get above the 7 wins they had. Obviously, if I'm going over 8, then I'm saying they're going to have a winning record, which they haven't had under Rivera. But, 9 wins isn't, I don't think, is a crazy number. So I would say over. Can we timestamp this? I don't know what other scandals are coming, or I don't know what other controversies are going to happen, or who knows, or, the alien invasion is going to come down and take, Chase Young away with them. And so he doesn't, I don't know, who knows what's going to happen with this team, but I would say the over. I think there's just a lot of reasons to think that they can get above the 7 wins and therefore above the 8 wins at this point.
I like it, man. I always end up betting the over just because I'm a chump Commanders fan, and it usually doesn't work out well for me. Maybe this will be the year. We'll see. Ben, where can listeners find you, man? Plug away.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Obviously, my written work is on The Athletic. I appreciate everybody who's subscribed there, and I have a podcast, Standard Room Only, which you can find on iTunes or anywhere you do your podcasting. Twitter is at Ben Standig. I'm trying to cut down on my social media focus. It's, you know, always a bit of a dangerous place, and you know, it's not the positives do not outweigh the anxiety and the negatives, but nonetheless, I am there and do try to engage as best I can. So feel free to hit me up there. And you know, at the end of the day, you know, covering the NFL is not a bad way to go through life. So I, you know, it's fun to do it. It just, you know, at some point here, it'd be more fun just to have a podcast or two or an article or two that's just focusing on the football itself and not all this other stuff.
I hear you, man. I hear you. Ben Standig, senior writer for The Athletic. Big fan of your work, buddy. I highly recommend everybody checks out the columns on The Athletic. I really like the podcast too. So thanks for coming on. I appreciate you making this work. Good luck at minicamp this week.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
There it is, ladies and gents. Don't know about you. Looking forward to some golf gambling this weekend. I hope everybody does well. Happy Father's Day to any fathers who are out there. I would love to tell you what we're doing on this show next week, but I have no idea. I can promise you, however, it's going to be good, and it's going to come out on Wednesday, as usual. Otherwise, thanks for rating, subscribing, reviewing IG at Rambling and Gambling, and the old email, ramblingandgamblingpodcast@gmail.com. Almost forgot the email again. Everybody, have a great week.